they continue to insist that what they're doing is new, because a state that sees the intervention of these institutions in its domestic affairs, that state is a member of the institution, and membership alone is continually emphasized as being significant, right? Membership alone is kind of said to be something that differentiates cooperation from empire, or from kind of informal imperial forms of cooperation, in part because membership provides some form of representation, right? You can kind of complain about your treatment at the institution that's treating you in this way. Of course, these are quite formalistic and often quite thin justifications for trying to get states to willingly agree to what often ended up being rather heavy-handed forms of intervention.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
Hi, this is Andrew Elrod, coming to you from the research office at United Teachers Los Angeles.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Today we're joined by Jamie Martin, Assistant Professor of History and Social Studies at Harvard University. And we have him here to discuss his new book, The Meddlers: Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Global Economic Governance. It's a very timely book, reconsidering the historical foundations of 20th century internationalism, and it comes out just as a new series of crises rock and reconfigure the mechanisms of global economic governance in our own time. So we're really excited to have him. Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we like to start off just by getting a sense of, you know, who you are and helping our readers to understand, you know, where you're coming from. So how did you become an historian, and how did you come to this topic in particular?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm a historian who kind of focuses on the history of political economy, the era of the world wars particularly, but also a bit after 1945 and a bit before 1914 as well. I did my training in history, but I actually kind of came to history with more of a background in philosophy, in the history of philosophy. And as I started my PhD, I was actually more kind of focused on intellectual history, but I started moving in the direction of political economy during my PhD, in part, as a result of kind of what was happening around me at that time, in the early 2010s, 2010s, whatever we call it. I think as you may see in the book that there is an element of intellectual history in the book, an element of history of economic thought. But now I'd say I kind of generally define the genre, the kind of genre or sub-discipline that I specialize in as the history of international political economy.
Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't realize you had a background in philosophy as well. What philosophers were you intrigued by prior to being seduced by history?
Yeah, it's a good question. It feels a bit like ancient history. But when I was an undergraduate, I did a lot of work in the history of German idealism and German philosophy. So yeah. I got really wrapped up with a lot of Hegelianism and the kind of that world. But
and then you were just convinced that in order to do good philosophy, you had to be an historian.
Well, I had an undergraduate advisor who said to me at one point, you know, as far away as I strayed from Hegel, eventually I would be drawn back to him. But I have to admit it hasn't yet fully happened yet. But anyway, I ended up doing graduate work kind of in the history of political thought at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And, you know, after that, you know, just kind of one thing led to another, and I ended up in a somewhat different place, but in a place I think that, you know, draws on my previous training and interests as well.
Yeah.
I see the continuity as very, very clear in terms of this book hoping to describe a kind of quasi-global sovereignty, which, you know, maybe is coming into existence or maybe, as you argue, has come into existence during the 20th century. So I appreciate that little bit of background.
as you kind of alluded to yourself, like this book is a really complex mixture of genres. It seems like it's both intellectual history, but then also economic history, and then like majorly political history, right? But it's also like a history of political culture. So it's like, as I see it, the change over time that you're tracking is practices of empire that used to be, you know, applied to like Egypt or the Ottoman Empire, you know, places that had like were lowered down on the rung of, you know, imperial power, bringing those into the core of Europe and really applying them to quote unquote civilized states or states that like, you know, thought they had more status than they turn out to have in the interwar period. And so you need new justifications for them. And that changes, well, I guess that's the question is, does that change what they are? Does that change them from being imperial practices into something new that we might call economic governance? Or, you know, how do you parse that difference, or is there a difference?
Yeah, so I mean, the book ultimately, in a kind of a basic sense, is an institutional history, or it's a series of institutional histories, you know, describing the rise of what I call in the book the first wave of international economic institutions that, you know, come onto the scene during and in the aftermath of the First World War. So kind of bringing the story back from the familiar starting point of Bretton Woods and saying, look, you know, the kind of birth of global economic governance begins quite a few years before the conventional starting point of 1944 at Bretton Woods. But, you know, in the process of tracing the rise of these institutions and the kinds of powers that these institutions were able to wield, I did end up kind of having to dive into these questions, as you put it, of political culture, also of law and legal history, kind of, you know, questions about political thought, at least, or maybe more kind of aptly ideology and how political thought plays out in practice and policies and in the justification for policies. And one of the reasons that I think I made the decision to kind of go in that direction with the book was because of my decision to focus on how these new international institutions actually were able to wield real power on the ground, right? So it wasn't just about the kind of creation of the institutions themselves and what went into that, but also these moments at which the institutions were able to tell a government, for example, you know, to lay off civil servants, right? To do something quite dramatic, or to get involved in, you know, quite detailed questions about agricultural production or something like that. And in order to bridge that gap, I found that I ended up having to weigh into questions about national politics, about political culture, you know, reading newspapers, for example, and seeing how people, you know, in various places were describing the interventions of these institutions in domestic arenas of party conflict or over, you know, domestic distributional questions. And as the book kind of trended in that direction over time, you know, it really ended up, I think, blending various different kind of practices of history, you know, drawing on, you know, kind of cultural history to a certain extent, but more so, I would say, kind of various political histories and legal history and, you know, as you put it, kind of broadly, the history of political culture. So, you know, it's difficult for me to say exactly, you know, what is the genre of this book. I think it blends genres. I think the kind of easiest umbrella term, as you put it, would be a political history, a kind of an international political history. But one of the kind of, you know, one of the things I do try to achieve in the book is to, you know, look at politics in a kind of a, or political economy in a broader way than just, you know, in terms of economics or kind of party politics.
So maybe one of the ways to sort of trace the full transformation from the first chapter to the last chapter is in the transition between Arthur Salter to John Maynard Keynes. Because Salter is a guy who's involved, I mean, you're going to tell us more about this, obviously, but he's involved in constructing, I guess, a total warfare state to govern the global economy. By the time you get to the mid-40s, it's Keynes who's setting up the Bretton Woods institutions, get everything that he wants, but that's sort of what we have today. And so maybe we should start with Arthur and what his vision was and why it doesn't survive the war.
Yeah, so I actually really like this kind of this way that you put it of the book. You know, if we kind of had to put two figures to explain the kind of the beginning of the book and the end of the book, this move from Salter to Keynes is quite interesting, at least in the British context. So Arthur Salter, just for some kind of explanation or biographical details here, was a kind of career civil servant who at a very young age gets put into position of quite significant influence in the British wartime state during the First World War, essentially dealing with problems related to shipping as they impacted the British war effort. And, you know, he's quite a clever character, you know, kind of an ambitious, technocratically minded individual. And during the war kind of with increased urgency in the last year of the war, ends up in collaboration with some of his colleagues from other allied states, particularly France, creating this set of institutions or kind of institutional matrix that will allow for coordination among the allied powers as they wage this total war. Essentially, you know, some kind of embryonic system, wartime system of global economic control and management, focused primarily on questions of shipping and coordinating shipping among the allied powers, but ultimately coming to embrace a larger set of economic problems concerning food, raw materials, the supply of armaments, and so on and so forth. And the reason why Salter is significant is not simply because he kind of stands, at the center of the construction of this extraordinary kind of global technocratic wartime system. I mean, I refer to it kind of, you know, without too much exaggeration, as really a kind of a system of global economic planning to a certain extent during the war.
You have this wonderful quotation of the office as a kind of nerve center, brain, of the Allied powers.
Yeah, exactly. It was meant to be a kind of a way of coordinating information and kind of an exchange of, I mean, even just to get personnel together in one room so that they could coordinate what did amount to kind of at least to a certain degree, a form of planning. Of course, on the national level, all of these wartime states are developing mechanisms that are kind of embryonic national systems of economic planning. So it's perhaps no surprise that a similar thing is playing out on the international level. But the real significance of Salter in the longer term here is that after the First World War, he then becomes an extremely influential and significant figure in the League of Nations, and in particular in the elaboration of economic functions at the League of Nations. And he himself understands kind of, you know, and writes, you know, explicitly about this, that the League's economic powers represent a kind of an institutional evolution out of this wartime context, right? They kind of, the League repurposes and inherits personnel and practices from these wartime bodies of economic collaboration.
What was the problem with shipping that he was solving?
Basically, what you see happen is that certainly, from the beginning, you know, early 1917, with the beginning or the kind of return to German strategy of unrestricted submarine warfare, you see this kind of, you know, mounting problem of shipping losses. And this becomes particularly pressing for the French and the Italians, who see increasing shortages, shortages of food, shortages of coal, shortages of other goods, and this increased sense of, you know, anxiety that they're not going to be able to emerge victorious from this war if their shortages continue to compound, right? Because these states are dependent on overseas sources of many vital goods, food, you know, coal in the case of Italy, and of course, kind of various industrial raw materials, right? The manufacture of the shells that are fired all along the Western Front, in the case of the Allied powers, relies heavily on nitrates that are mined at this point almost, you know, exclusively basically in Chile. So if you lose access to Chilean nitrates because you don't have enough ships to get them to Europe, you know, you'll lose the war. The Germans have established a method of kind of synthetically fixing nitrates. Anyway, I won't go too much into the nitrate story unless we want to. But basically, there's a major problem of shipping shortages. And during a war that relies on far-flung sources of inputs, you need to have ships. The other problem that happens is that when the United States joins the war in April 1917, suddenly you have another logistical challenge, which is getting all of these American soldiers across the Atlantic to Europe. So kind of
American bottoms had been used in freight for the European powers, suddenly now have to be redeployed for American the American war effort, right? So I mean, would it be accurate to say, you know, that, you know, they're scheduling, you know, there's a shortage of ships, but in order to resolve this logistical problem, they have to set up a kind of planning bureau rather than something like a trading floor where people just bid up the price of freight.
Exactly, because part of the problem, exactly as you mentioned it, Andrew, is that the, you know, it's not only shipping, but it's also freight, you know, is increasing dramatically at this point. And what happens is that when this system of kind of coordinated shipping cooperation is created, one of the ways in which it organizes its business and makes its decisions is on the basis of particular goods, right? So it's not just that Italy needs X amount of ships, it's that Italy needs X amount of coal. And how is Italy going to get that amount of coal? Well, here are the ships available. You know, Britain's got the coal, you know, the coal's kind of ready to get there. But how it gets there becomes a pressing logistical issue.
So this sounds like a great system. I mean, Arthur Salter is making the ships run on time, you know, and that's something that we all want. Why don't we keep this?
It was a system that during the war, particularly during 1918 and 1919, that many people in many different countries saw as promising something potentially extraordinary that would have real peacetime uses, right? Across a multiplicity of different kind of social movements, government offices, intellectuals, there was this enthusiasm that this kind of problem of, you know, needing far-flung sources of industrial inputs, of food, in a highly interdependent world economy, suddenly, you know, this problem had a new solution. And this became particularly important for the French, who, and the French Ministry of Commerce and the French government towards the end of the war, who recognized that France was going to be in need of, you know, reconstruction, obviously, after the war. And that France needed some new mechanism for containing post-war Germany, and containing post-war Germany in this case through a kind of a system of essentially economic sanctions or economic containment. The idea here was that if the Allies kept this system in place after the war, that they'd be able to direct resources to where they needed to go, like France, and they could keep resources from going where they didn't want them to go, like to a potential enemy state like Germany. Kind of interestingly, it's only once this vision falls apart, as other historians have shown, that the French turn to reparations as an alternative, right? And we kind of all know how the story of reparations goes. This was the plan A. It's also something that becomes very, very interesting.
And so the French aren't able to keep this system around because American capitalists don't like it, or the Brit, like what's the conflict that actually leads it to not sort of working out?
Yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, it's the resistance of American business, but it's not exclusively American business. It's also business in, you know, even in France and in the United Kingdom, because this wartime system, as you can imagine, had required sacrifices of business. It had required selling of goods at non-market prices. It had, you know, it had kind of cut into the bottom line of companies that could have been turning huge profits on the prices, you know, that were rising so dramatically during the war. And there was also just, you know, a kind of a general sense in which business, you know, said, okay, well, we had kind of, we'd allowed ourselves to be corralled for the sake of this kind of great national cause, but now the war is over, right? And we want kind of freedom to operate as we wish. We don't want this heavy-handed government intervention anymore. So the American state arrives, you know, the kind of representatives of the American state arrive in Europe at the end of the war and say, look, there's absolutely no way this system is being allowed to be carried over into the peace, even though there was some government backing for it, you know, among the French and even to a certain extent among the British. But kind of everywhere, there's a private backlash to the perpetuation of the system after the war.
A big part of the rhetorical thrust, you know, of your argument is that this international coordination, you know, is new. You know, you described it as a first wave. But I wonder, you know, is it true that, or, you know, how is it different that earlier forms of kind of diplomatic agreements over commodities, access to raw materials, would be excluded from this story? And just, you know, just for example, you know, the fishing rights to, you know, Newfoundland, and, you know, in the 18th century, you know, you have these kingdoms, you know, there had been kind of economics and diplomacy is not something new to the 20th century. So maybe, you know, one question I have is what is new then in this story?
Yeah, absolutely. Economics and diplomacy are, you know, they're as old as we can imagine in certain ways. And, you know, certainly in the 19th century, you see, you know, tariffs clearly becoming subject to diplomacy. Think of all the bilateral trade treaties that are reached, most favored nation clauses. It is certainly not the case that what I'm saying in the book is that you suddenly see a kind of a, that everything is new under the sun. Really, what the book is charting is the rise of these multilateral institutions or executives or multilateral institutions that attempt to wield some kind of executive power that are able to weigh in ultimately on quite fundamental questions of national policy. I mean, the other thing that, another kind of important kind of predecessor here is that in the 19th century, there were actually a relatively large number of international agencies that dealt with problems related to commerce. They just weren't particularly powerful. Their scope was very limited. They dealt with questions about standardizing measurements or statistics and data gathering. They were understood at the time to be quite useful as these kind of embodiments of technocratic internationalist, cooperation. But those institutions themselves, these kind of emerging international institutions, they were not empowered to deal with questions like tariffs. They weren't empowered to deal with questions about public finance or commodities and raw materials. That's what's new. That is what the book is tracing, is the rise of what I term, what I describe using an anachronistic term, admittedly, as these kind of first institutions of global economic governance, these kind of international bodies that are able to exercise real power over quite significant matters of national economic policy.
All right, so that's Arthur Salter. How do we get to Keynes from there?
Yeah, so Arthur Salter, as I mentioned, he's absolutely foundational for the kind of the first decade or so of the League's existence and the elaboration of what are the most kind of powerful and effective forms of economic governance, particularly in the financial realm, that the League was able to develop. The 1930s is obviously quite a difficult period of time for international organizations to be exercising real, quite significant powers of economic governance, in the midst of the Depression, in the midst of the kind of retreat from liberal internationalism and so on and so forth. So the story kind of in a certain way, picks up again in full form in the 1940s. And this is when Keynes himself, who has in certain ways a similar background to Salter. I mean, he's obviously a scholar in a way that Salter isn't, but he and Salter know each other. They're, kind of in conversation from the beginning. But Keynes is not playing a major role in these international institutions in the interwar period. He kind of goes through a period of being in the wilderness policy-wise. But in 1940, he assumes a position in the wartime government and, of course, leads the way on the British side of negotiations for what would become the Bretton Woods agreements. I mean, one kind of important shift here, I think, is the rise of economists like Keynes himself into positions of authority. So it's kind of no coincidence that Keynes's American counterpart is also an economist, right, in the U.S. Treasury. Well, this wasn't the case, in the earlier periods. Economists are around, but they are nowhere near as significant as they would be later.
So I'm curious, how your project developed over the course of your archival research. The tone of the initial chapters of the book is pretty hopeful for a world after empires. But by the time we get to the final chapter, we're reading a story about inter-imperial rivalry and hegemonic transition. The world of equal nation states joined in self-government is unquestionably replaced with the inherited patterns of imperial domination. So did you sort of know that that was the tonal shift that you were going to take? Or is that something that you had to come to in the course of sitting in the archives and sitting with this stuff?
Well, the project evolved a great deal, and it kind of it evolved and continued to evolve and evolved almost up until the moment I sent the book off to the for the final proofs.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I wouldn't say that it started off. I would kind of push back on the idea that my tone, or my at least intended tone, was to kind of start out optimistically and then to become more kind of pessimistic as time went on. I think that, you know, as I was working on the book, there was always a critical awareness of the history and of the idea that from the beginning, this sure. kind of, you know, practices and ideas of liberal internationalism were fraught by these contradictions and, you know, hypocrisies. And so the book was, you know, from the get-go intended to be something of an imminent critique, or at least have an element of an imminent critique of liberal internationalism, at least as it played out at this moment and in these domains. However, I do think that you're right, perhaps, to pick up on something of a engagement with a sense among contemporaries of a missed opportunity, of a moment in which there was kind of profound internationalist enthusiasm among many different actors, among, you know, these kind of high level state officials, but also among, you know, Marxists and feminists and all kinds of groups for creating institutions of economic governance that could perform various aims or kind of, you know, achieve various aims. And that kind of, as the 20s goes on, you know, there's kind of an increasing fallback on these older imperial practices and a sense among, you know, contemporaries that, you know, this project had been marred in a certain way by these tendencies. And, you know, I think that the book is tracing some sense of kind of disappointment among some of the contemporaries, but I wouldn't want the book to be read as though, I thought that, you know, at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, that some kind of, you know, fully representative and just system could have emerged out of that war. However, I do think recapturing, you know, the kind of sense of enthusiasm and optimism among such a broad array of actors at the time, you know, does show us something significant.
Could you tell us a little bit about how the project developed? You know, you mentioned that it had various forms, or that maybe you're thinking about it, you know, changed. I'd love to know just about the experience of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the project was quite different. It started as a PhD dissertation, and as a PhD dissertation, it actually focused more on kind of questions about expertise and the history of economic thought. And you know, in the way in which kind of some ideas were kind of cashed out in policies and other ideas were left behind. So there's a little bit more of a kind of charting of a broad terrain of policy possibilities and kind of looking at blueprints and things that worked and things that didn't. And as the dissertation evolved into a book, I kind of made the decision to focus actually much more on how power was really wielded in practice and what that looked like. And again, as I kind of mentioned earlier, in making that decision, I moved a little bit further away from just excavating the intellectual history of experts to really look at how, you know, these institutions of global governance or of international cooperation, you know, were actually in certain ways able to become quite muscular. And to become in certain ways quite coercive. And this involved moving away from the economists, because certainly in the 1920s, they weren't the ones who were really calling the shots.
Just one episode in your long trek away from philosophy and into international political history.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So the book starts out with an argument about periodization, that we think of the birth of global economic governance as happening Bretton Woods, 1944. It's a post-war thing. So a big part of the project is reperiodizing what we think of as global economic governance. And you push it back, you know, to World War I. I'm curious what the stakes are for this, pushing it back to the earlier period, and what the stakes would be for keeping it at this sort of post-World War I moment, as opposed to maybe seeing it in central bank cooperation in like the 1890s or something like this?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So obviously there's the kind of, you know, historian's desire to kind of, you know, set the record straight, so to speak, and to say, hey, these things that you thought were really new at this moment actually weren't. But it goes beyond that. And I think that one of the real stakes of the kind of that particular argument of the book is to say that we think of the rise of global economic governance really as originating in this kind of extraordinary moment of US kind of New Deal internationalism, right? Where suddenly the kind of forces align in the right way, and the United States is able to emerge out of something like isolationist retreat, you know, under the Roosevelt administration, and voila, we get Bretton Woods, something that, you know, in the years before was unthinkable, and that kind of since then has proven also to be unrepeatable, right? A big part of this narrative, as it's been told, is that, you know, what was the kind of unique genius of Bretton Woods? Well, it allowed for this kind of fundamental reconciliation of something like a moderate form of globalization with the Keynesian and New Deal states, right? You get, you know, states rejoining a world economy that was, you know, reconstructed while at the same time having more autonomy to experiment with welfarism, with expansive macroeconomic policies, and so on and so forth. I think if you move the story back, and you say that actually this project doesn't emerge kind of out of the blue as a result of this particular kind of conditions of U.S., you know, political U.S. politics and the kind of realignment of interest groups in the U.S. and so on and so forth. If you move the story back, you actually see a story of continuity, as you mentioned. You see that Bretton Woods is a crucial moment in a longer term evolution in how states and empires, you know, attempted to kind of collectively superintend the global capitalist system. And of course, there are kind of myriad 19th century and earlier precedents for this. You know, I wouldn't want to deny that. But I think that the key moment here, the kind of the key 19th century precedents leading up to this story, are the kind of elaboration of new forms of informal financial empire from the late 19th century, and the way in which particularly European, but also the United States, particularly European empires, but also the United States, are able to develop ways of exercising, you know, informal forms of control over the domestic economic policies and kind of sources of assets and resources of many formerly sovereign states around the world. And what you see after the First World War is the creation, the kind of the emergence of these new sets of institutions that essentially draw on these particular 19th century traditions of, you know, informal empire, right? And so by seeing Bretton Woods as part of that story of transition from this kind of later 19th century context up to the post-1945 period, I think is significant, not just for questions of periodization, but to kind of fundamentally recast what, you know, the kind of, you know, normative perhaps and kind of analytical stakes of charting the history of global economic governance are.
It's revelatory in, both to read and to hear you talk about it now. You know, when you know, in a typical, you know, freshman history course, there's European history. You know, maybe you learn about the Schlieffen Plan, or you know, you learn about Versailles. But it's really focused on Europe and maybe the rise of American power. But what you're showing, you know, seems to be a continuity between something like the Egyptian Debt Commission, you know, the history of what we would come to call the Third World, the imperial periphery, and then drawing a very clear continuity from that to something like the Dawes and Young Plan, which before, you know, in a kind of typical diplomatic history that I was taught, there's no way to fit the Dawes and Young Plan in other than as like terms you have to remember. But you very clearly show the continuity here about the stakes of control over sovereign debt. Maybe on the first read, readers might think it's a gamble or something, but just now being able to talk about it in that way seems like it has a huge payoff.
Well, if I'm able to make the Dawes Plan interesting to your listeners, then, you know, my job is done.
One, maybe we're jumping ahead here. And so, Nick, you know, feel free to rein me in, but it seems like, you know, the argument about the newness of this, you know, is a big part of it. But then the newness rests on this claim about multilateralism. And I wonder, you know, when we think about like the Dawes Plan, or you make a very strong, you know, I learned something reading your book about the origins of some of this stuff in the Austrian loan, you know, following Versailles, you know, this austerity plan that the new international institutions impose on the Austrian government. It seems like places where this new type of power, you know, what you're calling the international economic governance, the places where it's wielded are places that have been defeated,
yeah,
militarily. They're being dominated by foreign, you know, well, I mean, I guess there's a question. Are they being dominated by a foreign government, or is international economic governance, you know, a new multilateral thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear, you know, how you kind of think about that. I mean, for me, it seems like almost a philosophical problem.
Yeah.
About you know, legitimacy and power and government. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So when the League of Nations develops these quite robust programs of essentially financial, you know, providing financial bailout loans, conditional financial bailout loans, you know, not unlike what the IMF would do later, these projects are first brought to states like Austria, Hungary, and Bulgaria. There's a few others, but those are kind of quite significant ones. And they are held up as great successes, both then and later, particularly the Austrian scheme. Austria in the early 1920s is undergoing extraordinary hyperinflation. The state looks as though it may simply collapse. And the League of Nations steps in and, you know, provides the funds and the kind of heavy-handed control that allows the Austrian state to achieve some level of financial stabilization. So later, when the kind of, you know, successes and failures of the League are being tabulated, the League's role in kind of bailing out Austria is held up as, look, this was really effective. This demonstrated, you know, at the time in the 1940s, when people are kind of gathering and thinking about, you know, new post-war international economic organizations, they look back on this and they say, well, actually, look, this was a demonstration of the fact that global economic governance, you know, can work, right? But the problem at the time in the 1920s, exactly as you pointed out, Andrew, for so many contemporaries around the world, not only in Europe, but in Latin America and China and elsewhere, is they're looking at the elaboration of this kind of, you know, financial rescue plan. And they're saying, look, it's no coincidence that this scheme, which involves, you know, the empowerment of you know, a foreign advisor in these states to exercise veto control over fundamental questions of fiscal policy, over the size of the government, over questions about welfare benefits, and so on and so forth. They're saying there's no coincidence that these programs have only been deployed in those states, you know, or almost only deployed in those states that lost the war, right? And so it creates this problem. The League of Nations officials are saying, no, look, we're developing this new method of kind of benign international cooperation. We're getting away from this 19th century imperial baggage. But at the time, people are saying, well, not only does this look very close to empire, but why is it only acceptable in those states that have been defeated? And certainly among states that were on the victorious side of the war, and even those that faced extreme financial instability themselves, say a state like Portugal, they look at the Austrian-Hungarian schemes and say, we're not going to allow this because we're fundamentally different from Austria-Hungary. We're, you know, we're among the victorious allied powers. So it poses this huge problem that, you know, if you allow an international institution to become this deeply involved in your domestic affairs, you're kind of admitting to a loss of status and autonomy that is potentially tantamount to that of a state that recently lost a war.
And does it succeed anywhere? Are there victorious powers which must succumb, or with, you know, whose leaders voluntarily, you know, assent to having these sovereign decisions taken away from them?
The important exception here is Greece. Of course, Greece, you know, is a very complicated history during the First World War, but ultimately comes to fight alongside the Allied and Associated Powers, and kind of, you know, in some sense, count itself among the victors of the war. But Greece was also a state that, you know, occupied another position in this kind of league table of global hierarchies. It was a state that, you know, for decades had already had foreign-run commissions controlling sources of public revenue and kind of, you know, weighing in on questions of public finance. So at the time, it was clearly understood as being only a semi-sovereign state when it came to questions of, you know, public finance and kind of domestic economic decision-making. And so, again, you know, contemporaries looking out, they'd say, well, we don't want to be in Austria because Austria is a defeated state. We also don't want to be a Greece because Greece is a state that, you know, in a certain way has never been able to fully enjoy full autonomy over its domestic economy.
And just to kind of get into why these nations needed these loans, it's to finance trade, to finance imports, like Austria,
No, it's basically, I mean, in the case, Greece is you know, interestingly and complicatedly different. But in the case of Austria, essentially the idea is to provide you know, a bailout loan to essentially kind of, you know, allow the Austrian government, you know, some breathing space so that it can implement these quite, you know, significant programs of domestic austerity, kind of, you know, essentially the post-war Austrian Republic inherits a government apparatus from an empire that is simply much larger than the Republic. And, you know, one of the things that is seen at the time as being necessary is to radically shrink the size of this government. You know, the Austrian Republic is paying out, you know, it's paying out subsidies for food. You know, it's doing various things to kind of hold together quite a fragile post-war society. And all of this is seen as ultimately unsustainable on the public fisc, right? So, right. I mean, it's the kind of the traditional way of dealing with inflation, or one of the traditional ways. And it's a way that certainly continues to be, you know, looked to today, you know, is you get a government to kind of radically slash public spending, you get the Austrian state to remove the central bank from parliamentary control. And, you know, this loan is intended to kind of provide some breathing space so that these reforms under the direction and control of this foreign advisor can be overseen.
When I think about these kind of structural adjustment programs, I guess later in the 20th century, the austerity comes as a condition for the loan, which is needed for something like, you know, intervening to keep up your currency, intervening in currency markets. And so that's why I wonder, you know, why would you need a loan if you're just going to cut expenditures? You know, what is the money for?
It's a good question. Structural adjustment, I mean, it's kind of structural adjustment is much kind of far further reaching ultimately, and kind of the aims of what the IMF, you know, is intending to do and is able to do later in the 20th century kind of far surpass this program that's implemented in Austria. And also, of course, it reflects, you know, the common understanding at the time of what is driving inflation. You know, again, as I mentioned, this is not there isn't a sense of inflation here as something that is being kind of worked through by a team of crack academic economists. There's simply this sense of which kind of, you know, what's driving this? What must be this extraordinary government outlay on benefits, on employees, so on and so forth? And so really the point here is to, you know, allow the state to essentially be supported externally while it undergoes this extraordinary, far-reaching and painful program of austerity.
Shifting tracks a little bit, I was just thinking as you were talking of like placing your book in conversation with some of the other historiography that I'm familiar with. And I don't know if you know like Paul Schroeder's book, like The Transformation of European Politics, or this new one that just came out, Patrick O'Coore's The Atlantic Order of the World. And they're both international historians, diplomatic historians, and they use this phrase learning process, that they're tracking like a century-long learning process of how to actually make a peaceful Europe. For Schroeder, it's sort of 1750 to 1850. But for O'Coore's, it's sort of like, I think, 1870 through like World War II. Kind of your period. I mean, your book moved away from intellectual history over the course of the project, but I mean, could you read this as a kind of learning process of how to actually set up legitimate institutions or institutions that have sufficient legitimacy to successfully govern?
No, I don't think I would narrate my book at all as a process of successful learning. In fact, you know, one kind of simplistic way to read the narrative is, you know, why didn't people learn? Why do they keep repeating these same mistakes? I mean, I've learned, you know, a ton from Patrick Kaur's work, particularly on the Dawes Plan. His first book was really, really excellent on that. And I do think that there was a period of time in which the kind of real focus of European historiography, or one of the kind of central focuses of European historiography and international history as it focused on Europe, was to explain peace in Europe. You know, for a long time, the focus was on explaining the wars, right, and on the rise of fascism. Right. And then it suddenly became, well, it's quite, you know, why peace? Why suddenly, after centuries of war, did Europe become peaceful? So as part of a move towards this kind of question, you know, the literature began to focus on internationalism and human rights and European integration and the League of Nations itself, right? And as I began my work in, while I was doing a PhD, that kind of move, I think, in the historiography was still, underway. I think that one of the things, or one of the directions that my work ultimately ended up going, was away from trying to explain kind of the remarkable rise and success of internationalism, to instead trying to provide a kind of genealogy of certain forms of international power that have operated via these institutions of liberal internationalism. So, it was a move that I made that kind of drew on these trends and obviously this scholarship, but that ultimately aimed to do something quite distinct.
And so it's not a learning process, because they keep making the same mistakes again and again.
I wonder if it's a kind of problem that can be, the solution to which can be learned. I mean, right. In some ways, we're talking about power, sovereignty, domination,
Hence why the project moves out of intellectual history and into political history. It's just something that, it's a different genre.
But on the other hand, there's the question of legitimacy. Sorry, Jamie, this is, you should speak to this, but legitimacy maybe is something where you can learn how to exercise power in a different way.
Well, look at the figure of Keynes, coming back to Keynes. Keynes, from the vantage point of his wartime efforts to create, this new international monetary system or new rules for the international monetary system. And he's well aware of kind of past mistakes and well aware of what he doesn't want, right? And he doesn't want a system that will, allow international institutions, particularly if they're dominated by the U.S. Treasury, to, be heavy-handed, right? To kind of boss around its member states, not out of some kind of, I know this is a Keynesian podcast, so I don't want to slander Keynes too much, but I would say Keynes is not kind of like, deeply committed to sovereign equality for its own sake, right?
Not at all.
He's an imperialist at the end of the day. But he's deeply anxious that a weakened Britain, a Britain that's going to need to take out loans from the United States, and in a Britain that, whose empire is kind of, creaking, certainly, that he doesn't want the UK to be bossed around by the IMF, right? And so he's kind of looking back, and various people are looking back at the League of Nations and saying, well, that kind of worked okay at that moment, in part because the British, dominated themselves the financial activities of the League. But we certainly don't want that to apply to ourselves now, if this new international institution is going to be dominated by the Americans. Keynes, continues to insist with his U.S. counterparts that the IMF cannot place these heavy conditions on its financial assistance to member states concerning their domestic fiscal and monetary decisions. And the Americans seem to kind of vaguely agree and go along with it. But even before Keynes's death, he recognizes that whatever had kind of been vaguely agreed to during the war wasn't going to play out, right? And very shortly after the IMF, kind of begins its operations, it moves away from this apparent wartime consensus. So the question of learning is like, well, some people kind of, might have learned, and they certainly were aware of past excesses of things that had damaged past forms of international cooperation. But in practice, there's often, there was a kind of a recourse to older techniques of precisely the kind that Keynes worried would damage, if not destroy, the whole project of international economic cooperation.
You have to be defeated to learn something. And the had yet to happen to the U.S. Treasury.
that might well be the case.
And even on the legitimacy front, would you say that there was progress? I mean, it seems like in many of these periods, it's like the countries that are too weak to refuse it are the ones who get, have these multilateral institutions intervene. And then they, during the end of World War II, they say like, oh, we maybe won't do that in the future. But then after the war, like you said, they continue to do that, and they become, sort of unpopular, I think it seemed like, and seen as illegitimate in the places that they're intervening, but are too weak to avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, the question of legitimacy is kind of is important to the book, in part because how I see the architects and officials, kind of working in this first wave of international institutions, I see what they understand one of their jobs is as trying to legitimate a kind of power that had obvious pre-war, imperial precedents and analogs. they continue to insist that what they're doing is new, because a state that sees the intervention of these institutions in its domestic affairs, that state is a member of the institution. And membership alone is continually emphasized as being significant, right? Membership alone is kind of said to be something that differentiates cooperation from empire or from kind of informal imperial forms of cooperation, in part because membership provides some form of representation, right? You can kind of complain about your treatment at the institution that's treating you in this way. Of course, these are quite formalistic and often quite thin justifications for trying to get states to willingly agree to what often ended up being rather heavy-handed forms of intervention. But this was a constant anxiety. And you see this later with the IMF. I mean, US government officials, often say, well, why is the IMF, so significant and so different? Is because the IMF will make it much easier for states to commit to a certain course of action, much easier than if the US Treasury itself kind of showed up and say, hey, do this. Or if, Citibank, for example, kind of just shows up and says, hey, do this. So this mediating institution is supposed to make the kind of bitter pill easier to swallow, essentially.
Totally. So one of my big sort of personal intellectual turning points was I was doing a PhD in economics before I switched to history. And I went to an IMF conference in DC in 2013. Hmm. And it was the Fischriff for Stanley Fischer, who ran the IMF for a long time. And I was blown away by how explicit he was about exactly that point. I've got the quote written down somewhere. He says,
"Oh wow,
the IMF can ask for things that the U.S. Treasury can't, and that's politically useful. And we are the political." He says something like, "We are the political arm of whatever." I forget if he doesn't say American capitalism, but that's like what that's the implication of what he says. And so, just seeing that kind of raw, naked exercise of power. Yeah. By these institutions is we need to think about this in a very different way.
That's I'm so glad to hear that quote, because that's a very old kind of that idea and that justification for these institutions is there from the very beginning. Is there, that's 100 years old.
and yet to the national publics who become subject to these adjustment programs, the discovery or maybe allegation of American influence delegitimizes the international institution.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very hard argument to buy, right? I mean, if you're kind of being subject to austerity at the hands of this institution, at the end of the day, it almost doesn't matter who's controlling the institution, who's exercising outsized voice in the institution. It's not going to make that much easier for the people who are at the kind of, knife's edge of these policies. What it does help with, though, or at least many have argued, and it certainly was there from the beginning as a justification, is that this idea can be helpful for domestic political and economic elites to kind of, it can provide a scapegoat, right? You say, look, we have to do this austerity program that secretly we actually really want. And maybe, domestic financial institutions have been pushing us to, commit to these reforms or whatever they might be. But, we don't want to just be on the hook for enforcing them ourselves, because that will damage our political standing, so on and so forth. So look, we're being forced to do this by the IMF. Our hands are tied, fingers crossed that this won't, tank our popularity. But of course, again, it's often quite a risky strategy to kind of voluntarily give up control and autonomy to this international institution and hope that this somehow doesn't spark a nationalist backlash.
I mean, in the back of my mind, reading this stuff is, does it work? Does legitimacy, is it conferred by this international, economic governance? And just for, the history you're talking about is interwar Europe.
in that case, it doesn't work. It works. There's a few instances in which the League develops this kind of, extraordinary original power of conditional financial bailout, loans. But by the end of the 1920s, no one wants it anymore. Even states like Portugal or Poland that are in desperate need of, foreign capital say, we will not agree to the terms of a loan that disempower, you know, our governments from these vital decisions over domestic policy. Of course, in later contexts, they, you know, the story is different. So it depends, right, on where you're looking and kind of who you're asking. There's been great work done by the political scientist Jonas Bunta that's shown in a much more recent contemporary context about how a state chooses among its different foreign creditors. And he's shown, I think, convincingly that, you know, states in which domestic kind of financial sectors are powerful and politically influential, those states tend to be the ones whose governments are more kind of willing and eager to reach out to the IMF. Because often the reforms that the IMF will insist this government commit to are the same reforms that they're being pressured to commit to from this domestic interest group. Whereas states in which organized labor is more powerful, those governments are often kind of recognized that the political risks involved with this kind of delegation, you know, might outweigh the benefits.
And they seek credit elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, they seek credit from, you know, even China, for example. In China, kind of, you know, famously or notoriously, depending on your opinion, I suppose, you know, doesn't, you know, make these kinds of conditions, these kind of demands for austerity or kind of financial deregulation or whatever conditions of its loans.
For there to be international politics of this stuff, there have to be some choices.
Exactly.
I mean, this seems like a big difference between the history of the Cold War and today is that it. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that the Kennan's long telegram was sent on the occasion of Russia refusing to join the IMF. You know, there was no alternative international creditor for a lot of the Cold War.
Well, if you sort of look from a more recent context from the, you know, late 1990s the IMF is, you know, almost at the pinnacle of its power, you know, overseeing the kind of transition, so to speak, of, you know, most Soviet republics to capitalism, nearly every Soviet republic, and also obviously playing a leading role in coordinating basically the U.S. response to the Asian financial crisis. And, you know, there aren't really alternatives on the global stage to this kind of institution. However, today, you know, China certainly kind of emerging more into playing this role of emergency lender, not just kind of Belt and Road style infrastructure development lender. You know, China is very clearly kind of pitching itself as an alternative to the IMF. And one thing that I think has been demonstrated is that states that reach some kind of arrangement with China tend to get more lenient treatment from the IMF. So obviously the rise of, you know, kind of a much more competitive and multipolar landscape of global debt politics will force changes at these international institutions. However, this is well beyond the scope of my history book, but I think it's obviously relevant because these dynamics, you know, have quite long backstories.
Well, no, that's a perfect transition into my next question, which is that your book seems to be part of a spate of new books that are reconsidering the historical foundations of 20th century internationalism. I put it alongside like Adam Tooze, but also like Nick Mulder, Stefan Link. They all seem to be of a piece in some way. They're kind of coming out of the global turn from the early 2000s, but in a much more political and kind of political economy focus. So do you think that turn is happening? First of all, do you think that turn is happening? But then also, like, you know, is this responding in some way to our moment in particular, or are these kind of autonomous developments?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's hard to say. I'm not sure I would necessarily diagnose a turn, but I do think that there are various people who have kind of, you know, who are emphasizing different things and looking for the answers to different questions. You know, as I mentioned, there was this kind of turn, you know, all of those historians that you just mentioned, I mean, you know, all of them, and I would include myself in this, operate in kind of roughly something that could be described as international history with a focus on Europe, not exclusively on Europe, but a heavy focus on Europe. And as I mentioned, that kind of the center of gravity or a major center of gravity in that field in the kind of earlier 2000s was on these questions about peace and kind of, you know, the successes of liberal internationalism and the, you know, the kind of emergence of or the prehistory to the European Union and so on and so forth. And I think that for many people, and certainly myself included here, that those stories, you know, needed to be updated in part in light of you know, the kind of dramatically changing conditions, not only of Europe, but also of the world in the second decade of the 21st century. I mean, one very important context for me here was the role played by the IMF and the Troika in the Greek bailout. And, you know, I was doing my archival research literally at that moment into the League of Nations kind of, you know, bailout schemes and seeing, you know, it just added a different way of thinking about those schemes for me. And again, I don't want to be too presentist about it and say that just kind of, you know, changing conditions changes topics of research or whatever, but obviously it kind of fits into it.
Yeah, I mean, historians are historical actors too. We live in our own time and respond to our own conditions. I think that's not a fault.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the work that I did along with, you know, many other of my friends and colleagues and whatever, you know, I think it's almost become cliche to say this at this point, but I do think that the global financial crisis, you know, whatever we'd been working on before, suddenly, you know, many of us started to work on something different. It felt, you know, at that moment so pressing and so significant. And I think it's, you know, it's hard to exaggerate how much that crisis was for so many people, you know, a kind of a precipitating factor in rethinking so many questions about political economy or even getting interested in political economy in the first place. So I do think, you know, at the risk of repeating what is becoming something of a cliche, that I do think that that was foundational for turning many people to interrogate some of these historical questions as well.
Can I ask what, you know, where this research has taken you? You know, do you have a next project in mind? I mean, just the whole underscoring of the legitimation aspect of this for me opens up a variety of types of things you could do. But I wonder, you know, in terms of time and place, you know, what are you interested in now?
Yeah, so I do have a new book that I'm working on, and it's kind of both related and somewhat distinct. And the book is really on the global history of the kind of economic experience, let's say, of the First World War. So looking at how the war generates a series of economic crises that are felt, you know, essentially across the entire earth, you know, from even, you know, isolated rural areas, you know, in the United States, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Pacific Islands, in Latin America, and so on and so forth, and looking at how this world economy that had emerged before the war didn't fully collapse. I mean, this became quite a common thing for people to say, you know, over the last few decades of historiography on kind of global economic history, that the war is this kind of profound crisis of globalization that destroys the world economy. But actually what I think is happening is that the world economy not only is not destroyed, but the very kind of deep and profound integration of the world economy means that this series of crises are transmitted, you know, further than ever before. So really, you know, there's been a global kind of turn in the historiography of the First World War over the last decade or so. But really, it just hasn't taken on this kind of economic question. So that's what the book is. It's kind of, you know, it's big geographically focused, but it's narrow in the years that it looks at. Yeah, it's ultimately a context that I think is, you know, kind of in certain ways frighteningly similar to some of the instabilities in the world economy today. You know, questions about shipping shortages and supply chain disruptions, the global transmission of inflation. And then after the First World War, of profoundly devastating deflation. So that's the book as it stands right now.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to read it.
I can't wait to write it.
Okay, maybe this is almost a good place to end then. But I do want to ask, though, about lessons for today. You know, you've got this piece in, I think, The Nation, it's The Rotten Roots of the IMF. And you suggest at the end of your book that, you know, minor tweaks to these kind of institutions really aren't going to help us that much. So, I mean, maybe the most broad way to ask this question is just be like, how do we escape the imperial origins of global economic governance? Because, you know, it's kind of clear that we do need something like global economic governance to manage, you know, the instability of capitalism, and to prevent fascism and to prevent, you know, whatever. Like, we should have that as a political project, but having it as a political project in a world which already has so much inequalities and power and resources, how do you escape the imperial foundations?
It's a great question. And I think that, first of all, you're certainly right to say that, you know, the book is not a call for a full retreat from something like global economic governance. In fact, it's a call for, you know, more of it, just done differently and done in a way that does attempt to somehow chart a path outside of these legacies of empire. Now, the book does end, as you say, with saying minor tweaks kind of aren't going to get there. However, I don't want to throw the minor tweaks out completely. I mean, I do think there's actually a lot of really kind of, you know, encouraging and incredible mobilization being done right now to try to reform the way that the IMF, for example, does business by providing more liquidity to vulnerable member states with fewer strings attached, to, you know, expanding the scope of its resources and its ability to, you know, help states at the forefront of the climate crisis, right? Even in the New York Times this morning, you know, there's an article about the mobilization being done by various people, including the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, to really, you know, get global North leaders to, you know, commit to finally using these institutions for the kind of projects of, global cooperation that obviously the world is in need of. One of the reasons why I said the tweaks aren't going to be enough is because I think that actually, you know, this article in the New York Times this morning was very kind of optimistic that suddenly, you know, here's Yellen and Macron and all these people are saying, yes, we need a new Bretton Woods. We need to kind of fundamentally rethink what we're doing. Is that reforming the IMF has proven very, very difficult to do, in part because of the dominance of the United States in it, the fact that the U.S. wields veto power at the end of the day, and because U.S. congressional politics, you know, poses a real limit on you know, what the what any U.S. administration, or at least how a U.S. administration understands its relationship to the IMF and its relationship to these programs for reform. Part of me wants to resist the, you know, the technocratic temptation to say, look, I have the vision for what the new, you know, system of global economic governance could be, in part because I don't have that vision, but also because I don't think that it's something that can just be kind of, you know, like imposed top down from the blueprints of academics and certainly from historians. I think, you know, it's something that needs to be built, built from the ground up. And one of the reasons why, systems of global economic governance as they've existed have tended to trend in the direction of being kind of more heavy-handed, I think, is because they've often not focused on that, right? On kind of, you know, how is kind of this system that operates at such a high level, how does it coordinate with governments and social movements and interest groups on national and local levels. So, you know, I'm not sure that I have a perfect blueprint for fundamentally rethinking it, but part of the book was to provide historical ammunition for what I see as an important project of the 21st century, which is trying, you know, the search for systems of international cooperation that will be able to at least in some way respond to the existential challenges that we face.
Yeah, earlier in this interview, we were talking about maybe China and the emergence of multipolarity as, I mean, maybe not hopeful, but at least offering space for fairly significant reforms.
Yeah, I think that the rise of a more multipolar and kind of competitive landscape of lending will force changes. Again, as I mentioned, you know, not only the IMF, but also the World Bank, sees states that have prior loan arrangements with China as ultimately deserving more lenient treatment, right? In part simply because they don't want to lose the business. At least that's how I think that that's the most likely explanation for it. So I do think that this kind of, you know, system that, you know, the IMF, which was created at a moment of nearly unrivaled U.S. global dominance and which has existed basically almost unchanged in its reflection, of this previous moment of U.S. power, it just doesn't seem appropriate in that way for a much more multipolar world that we have today. This question is only going to become more significant, right? Of how do you get states to kind of agree to, you know, voluntarily relinquish some full discretion over questions of national policy? You know, certainly for kind of questions about climate, this is key, right? But the idea that you're going to kind of premise a system of international cooperation on browbeating states into kind of, you know, removing policy autonomy in places where it shouldn't be removed or what's not relevant to the crisis at hand, that this is not a stable system of international cooperation. This is not a system that kind of brings states to the table. It's a system that states will attempt to, you know, escape from. And we've seen that from the late 90s, right? All of these projects in which states have attempted to, you know, never need to call on the IMF again in the case of financial turmoil, essentially to kind of build up their sovereignty as a buffer against international cooperation or against international governance. So, you know, I think that, you know, coming to terms or kind of navigating and exploring this long history of how international cooperation has been, you know, has been fraught by this problem, eroding the autonomy of states excessively, I think that it's important for trying to think about how, you know, this might be done differently in the future.
It's a valiant and righteous effort, because for me, when I think about, competing sovereignties, international cooperation, I return to something like the electors of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's not that's not particularly a hopeful history. In my understanding,
I think nostalgia for the Holy Roman Empire is even worse than nostalgia for Bretton Woods.
All right, and again, we end on an anti-nostalgia note. That's the continuing theme here. All right, the book is The Meddlers: Sovereignty, Empire, and the Birth of Global Economic Governance. Thank you, Jamie, for this. This was a really great discussion.
Thanks so much for having me. This is a ton of fun.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.